Yes, Marie.
Okay, I'm here.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with me, Marie Wilson, president of the White House Project.
Oh, I'm happy to do it. It's something that has been the focus of my life for the last 10 years, and it couldn't be more timely, Anne.
Yes, absolutely. We are talking today, the day after the inauguration of our first African-American president, Barack Obama. And so because the mission of the White House Project that you are the president of is to really advance women's leadership in every arena, but all the way up to the U.S. presidency, Maria, I'd like to ask you, what's your perception today of where you see women in terms of moving up into those leadership levels in the context of the new chapter, perhaps, that our nation has opened beginning yesterday?
Well, I'm more optimistic than I have been since I started the White House Project 10 years ago. I feel like I've known that this was the time for women's leadership because everything that women have learned to do from the foot of the table is really what needs to be done at the head of the table. Obama himself, I think, exhibits that style of listening to people and incorporating their ideas. But what's exciting now is that where we are going, and even the crisis that we are in demands that we use all our resources and not to leave half of those at the table. I'm already seeing that in the cabinet in terms of the non-traditional appointments around security issues, Homeland Security, the State Department, Susan Rice at the UN is an indicator that three women are holding the top security positions that up until recently would have been an anathema. So it's our turn. We're going to lead in non-traditional places. And articles like the one that appeared in the Times yesterday about looking at the role of women in science now with this new focus that Obama is bringing both on science and this intellectual climate that we're in are showing that we're going to have a real opportunity to advance women's leadership. People are going to want, for the first time, to have women at the table because we are pushing who's got the new ideas, who's going to bring something different, who's going to be inclusive in terms of bringing voices in, and that will not only change things for women, but it will allow the men in this administration, and I think model it for the companies, to see that this is great in terms of bringing men's full opportunities and voices in as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I share your optimism, Marie, but also when you look at the facts, which I'm doing in this book that I'm writing, in all the arenas, the progress really in terms of women moving from being achievers, which we clearly are today, into those senior leadership positions in all arenas is really discouragingly slow. Why is it taking so long for us to move the dial when the pipeline is bursting with women of achievement?
Well, we've studied this for 10 years. We've looked at it in terms of how women promote themselves and are promoted. We've looked at it with regard to the cultural ideal of women in America that has never changed, being wife and mother, and that cultural ideal needing to be broken down by changing the popular culture that so influences how women can see themselves. We've done it by looking at how we have people understand that we don't get women moved when we do it one at a time and need to put numbers at the table. But, Anne, most of all, what has happened is this. People like to think of themselves in our country as fair, and they like to think of us as a meritocracy, but there is still a very strong perception that women are already leading. And it is very hard to solve. And I can tell you some amazing stories only recently of top people who think this, but this is a widely held perception that women are already leading in every sector. They don't know what we know about and have studied for years, which are the top 12 sectors where women never get above 18% of the leadership of that sector, even if they're more than 75% of the members of that sector. And they don't really want to look at the difference women could make. And finally, I think there's a perception that if women take those places, men have to step down instead of women want to lead alongside men, and this fear that it will replace men and that our boys won't have any place to go. I know this from years at the Ms. Foundation, take our daughters to work, all these concerns that instead of making it better for men, that it will not be as good as. So those kind of deeply held fears and perceptions keep us at a hard place.
Mm-hmm. And some of those have to do with perceptions and fears that men have, but one of the things I'm also interested in is your perception about specifically perhaps the ways women continue to sabotage our own individual and other women's leadership. What do you see about that?
Well, I see it in what Anna Fels wrote about our standing and stepping on our own ambition, our dreams deferred.
Yes.
I feel like that ambition, as I have gotten into this work and really looked at it, particularly through a political lens, that it is political ambition that has kept women out of the most visible leadership sector of all. So we sabotage ourselves by actually deferring our dreams, not encouraging each other to take the next step. That's so powerful. I never speak to a group without saying, if you don't call a woman in the next 24 hours and tell her the next leadership step you want her to take and encourage her to take that step, that something awful will happen to you, because I am magic, because I am desperate for women and men to encourage each other. It won't always need to be that way. But right now, it's a matter of our not deferring our own dreams and encouraging other women to take the next step in their dreams. And part of it is about doing it together. We have to understand that unless we start to negotiate not just with men, but with each other and say, I'm trying to get here. How can you help me? I'll figure out how to help you get there, or form groups where we're moving each other along. I'm seeing this happen in politics, where sometimes women are taking an issue and kind of running together on it so that they're moving along. And so, and in our political leadership training, we insist that you can become a part of a group, and you never leave a training without saying what you're doing for the other woman in the group or the other women. But it's about deferring our own ambition, not encouraging with the courage in that word each other to take the next step, and not understanding that we will only move if we move together.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad to hear you say that, because one of the points that I make in this book is that every woman for herself is a losing strategy for all of us.
Yeah, well, I think I can't agree with you more. It's a losing strategy. But when you see so few so few leadership positions, there is the fear that there's not room, and sometimes there's not. So the only way to do it is to figure out how to, expand the room, which I'm assuming your book is about.
Absolutely. And will you take a look at the list that you have in front of you of, I'm talking about 8 leadership qualities mm-hmm. that I see that women achievers need to start doing in terms of behaviors that they need to start building upon in order to become genuine leaders. Does anything jump out at you on that list, Marie?
Well, the thing that jumps out at me, and without a doubt, is all of these things are essential, but confidence is key. A few years ago, when we brought in leaders from other countries to look at why women matter and why it's important to have them in leadership and what they need to do, and an incredibly historical woman named Mo Mullen, who was with the British Parliament but dealing with Northern Ireland, dealing with Ireland, got up to the microphone. She was brave. She's somebody who was an amazing leader. She's known for having, during the peace process conversations, she had a brain tumor, so she threw her wig off when it got hot, kind of shocked everybody at the table. But she stood up at this and looked at the audience at the National Press Club, and she just almost yelled out, "And confidence. Confidence." And I cannot tell you how much I have learned, not only about myself, for God's sake, because it makes you look at yourself.
Yeah.
But in training thousands of women now, we have trained thousands of women, 6,000 women in the last 4 years, and several thousand just to run for office, and have started to see, of all the things we do in our training, the Humphrey Institute has evaluated what do women come out with. We give them skills. We give them information. We give them, you know, courage. We're great at giving them passion. We show them examples. We do everything that it takes to let you know you can lead in politics or any other place. But 61% of those women say, in the long run, they leave with confidence. And that's because that's what they came in needing. And so you can make the argument, well, yeah, when you get more information and when people inspire you and when you see more women out there, you start to feel more confident. But I think it is just the whole idea that what we are lacking, because the world does not work to give women confidence. I mean, what women face every day, I don't care who they are, is when they walk in the room as a woman, they still have to prove their mettle. I've got the research to show it. And when every day is still a new day to test your worth and your ability to lead, you're having to deplete your confidence as you're building it all the time. So I feel like we have to figure out some way to deal with the confidence crisis that the majority of women have.
You know, I really struggled with how much to address that in this book, because I'm assuming that women achievers have kind of mastered achievement 101 through 401, and now you take it to the next level. But why is it that seems to be women's Achilles heel, no matter how accomplished they are?
Well, and I think you have it under never eliminate yourself, opportunities,
yes,
confidence.
Yes, I put it there, right.
Yeah, because it is about what Cantor wrote about years ago is what changes things is when there are numbers of you and when you have real power, and when Rosabeth Moss Cantor, I should say.
Yes, of course, I know who you're talking about.
And opportunity, because opportunity is what gets you from an achiever to a leader, is you have to be ready to take advantage of opportunity, right?
Yes.
And by the way, that's why we are building a 10 to 12-year pipeline to power when we do our political leadership trainings, for instance, because if women haven't been trained, they will not take the opportunity when it arises in a political position that opens and closes in a few hours. And so, yes. So we're building a 12-year pipeline so that we have a 12-year trajectory of women across these states who know that they can do the job and that therefore they feel confident. But I think, Anne, it's so important, what we ignore this whole business that Eleanor Holmes Norton said years ago, you can't be what you can't see. I mean, Marion Wright Edelman, said years ago at the Children's Defense Fund, you can't be what you can't see. And when you can't see more women in leadership, then you don't know you can be that. The confidence, the lack of confidence, I think, comes from not seeing women in these roles, which is why we have worked so hard to get films and documentaries and to show women leaders and to get women out on television shows, because when you see other women doing it, you build confidence. Men see other men. They don't care if they're trained to run for office. They wake up and a position opens and they know they'll learn it later.
Right.
And
right.
Women have to know everything before they will step up to that position. And I've done work in companies years ago. I trained some of the first women who went into leadership positions in management in the late 70s, early 80s after the affirmative action lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was the same thing. Men would come in and we would simulate these situations where men would talk and women would talk, and after we had them have a discussion, which what they didn't know we were watching is what the process was. And of course the women asked the men after the meeting, after our little simulated meeting, how did you know certain things that you said in that meeting? And the men said, we didn't know, but we knew we could find out, and they felt confident.
Yeah.
And the world is not, when you don't see women in those positions, and when you have a kind of public perception of women still that's culturally of wife and mother in the home, and you don't see women leaders in film and television, you see other attributes of women, then you don't have anything to build that on rather than some kind of long-term achievement that you try to document. I can't tell you how many women I know who what they do today, they don't remember tomorrow. They may be achievers, Anne, but it doesn't stick, and so they're continually refueling it. Now, that's not all women, but I think it's the majority.
Yes, yes. And that relates to this question I also have about women and power, because actually aspiring to power, in order to make a difference, I think that women are perhaps motivated for power for different reasons than men. But to get women to aspire to power, which is really about leadership, you know, it's not just achieving, but to have the power to influence and change, you know, get other people to follow your vision and change the agenda. Is there some kind of cultural muck we're still struggling with there, and it's probably related to everything you've said?
I have learned more in the last 10 years working on getting women into real positions of power than I think I learned in the first 30 or 40 years of my life. I'm 68. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this work for a long time. Mm-hmm. And what I have learned is the discomfort still, I don't think of individual women so much as, again, the culture about when you start to get women into power. I started the White House Project because I had been, you know, created, co-created, take our daughters to work, and little girls wanted to be leaders and wanted to be the president, and I thought I better help. But I spent 20 years at the Ms. Foundation for Women, actually funding women who were coming up with the best economic and health and safety policies and strategies in the country, but never getting the praise for it, the credit, and having it shot down by the people who had the power to implement it or change it the next year. I began to think of women as the government in exile, and I wanted to put them into the government in power. But, Anne, I can tell you that when it comes to even getting money or support for putting women into leadership, it's not as easy. I think money is a great indicator, because when you're raising money, when you have women who are needing help, when you have women who are suffering from violence, when you have women who can't get jobs, people give money. People say, yeah, that's great. But there is something really difficult about getting money to make women leaders so that you change all those things that make women suffer. And that's been astounding to me, because women, for instance, if you look at the legislature, so often, inevitably, the reason a woman runs is not to have power, but to change a stop sign in the community. If it's on behalf of other people, we are happy to have that power. But the discomfort I feel like women still bring to having power and influence and saying, I want power and influence, even if it is to do good, which oftentimes it is, most often, even if it's passion for and purpose for changing their companies, et cetera, something about saying, I want power. And it's why I've been fascinated. The other great indicator of it are the political ambition studies, which show that women will more likely take a leadership position if other people say, you know, I'd like you to think about being, you know, to applying for the CEO. I'd like for you, I hope you'll apply, I hope you'll run for that Senate position. I mean, we're in New York right now where there's one open. Yeah. Trust me, I can tell you stories. Uh-huh. But what's interesting is for you to call up and say, I'm interested in that Senate seat, I'm interested in that position, is a risk, because, again, this whole thing about women aren't supposed to be ambitious, women are supposed to be, you know, kind of waiting to be asked and waiting to be asked to dance. And so some of that is just so deeply in the culture that we just have to, again, keep giving women that encouragement and courage until women see enough people to where they're willing to do it. And all of us can just do something like that every day to help each other, you know, just say, why aren't you thinking about that? Of course you should, because, you know, most women are sitting on top of it for fear that they will be seen as a pushy broad, a bad woman, not somebody who should be in leadership. And the best women leaders really have to get out there and do get out there and say, I'm interested in this position.
Marie Wilson, it has been so fantastic to talk to you. Thank you very much for talking to me today. We'll continue this conversation, and thank you for the decades of leadership work that you have done.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm still into it.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marie.
Thank you for your book.
Bye. Bye-bye.